It's time for a solid hour of business insights and strategies for success on Mind Your Business. And here's your host, the president and founder of Bottom Line Marketing, Yitzhak Saflis.
You're tuned to another edition of Mind Your Business with Yitzhak Saflis right here on 77 WABC in the New York, New Jersey metro area and around the world at WABCBizRadio.com. Our listeners know what this show is all about. It caters to C-level executives and the sole proprietor and everyone in between. It's for anyone that wants to get ahead in today's business world. It's also for, I get a lot of great feedback from people in the sales field, small business owners, medium-sized business owners. And what we do is we seek out C-level executives and ask them the questions that are on your mind so that you can get ahead in today's business world. Tonight's show is no different. We have a very special guest. But before we get to the guest, a couple of thank yous. Special thank you to Pesach Tropper, the show's producer, who helped orchestrate all the backstage activity to land such an incredible guest. Meira Bauman, the show's content creator. Cirilli Saflis, who handles the video production. And the entire team at Bottom Line Marketing Group, who plays an important support role for this show. Also, a special thank you to Jeffrey Hazlett, who invited me to this incredible conference. The background noise that you hear is from C-Suite Boston. We are coming to you live. This is live, pre-recorded, in Boston at the C-Suite Network Conference. It happens a couple of times a year. This particular one was in Boston. And that's where I had a chance to sit down with Ron Carucci. More about our very, very special guest. Ron is a world-renowned leadership consultant and best-selling author. And you'll hear his wisdom in the coming minutes during this full-length interview. Ron has worked with hundreds of CEOs and executives in 20 different countries around the world to transform their leadership. Ron is a co-founder and managing partner at Navalent. His clients include Citibank, Bristol-Myers, Starbucks, Microsoft, PricewaterhouseCoopers, Johnson & Johnson. That's pretty impressive, but if you're still not impressed, he also counts as one of his clients, the CIA. I think now you're impressed. He's the best-selling author of 8 books, including the recent Amazon number one bestseller, Rising to Power. I have a copy of it. Pretty impressive book. I say this as a compliment, a heavy book. A lot of information in that book. It's not a light read. It's an important read. It's an engaging read, certainly for anyone who's racing to the top. Ron also is a frequent contributor at Forbes and Harvard Business Review, HBR. Therefore, we encourage you to stay tuned for tonight's edition of Mind Your Business, where you're guaranteed to walk away with real takeaways on the traits of high-performing executives, learning to see the whole picture, navigating through conflict. With that welcome, we give a warm welcome to Ron Carucci. Ron?
Yes, Yitzhak, thank you so much for having me. It's a real pleasure to be here.
It's our honor and the honor of the many thousands that are tuned in and that will be listening on the podcast. Of course, this will be available. And I just want to remind all listeners, all the previous shows, the one we had with Captain Sully Sullenberger, the one we had with Jeffrey Hazlett, the one we had with Steven Sadov, the former CEO of Saks Fifth Avenue, and so many others, all our previous 33 episodes or 35 or so, are all available by going to WABCBizRadio.com. You just click on the face or on the title of the person, and it will pop up automatically their particular episode on the iTunes store. Let's jump right in. You define a business leader's rise to power in 4 steps, and I'm going to say them. Ascend, adjust, assert, and effect. Can you explain them for our audience?
Sure thing, Yitzhak. Let me start by telling you why we even looked at the journey in the first place. It's been known for 20 years that executives, upon 18 months of their appointment, about 50 to 60% of them fail. That's been a statistic for 20 years, and we've accepted it as normal. Of course, the recruiters love it because it's annuity for them. But when it became our clients, when our executives who were showing promising rises and lots of potential were being given chances to expand their wings into bigger roles and failing, it was hard. So we stepped back and asked ourselves, why have we let 50 to 60% of these men and women fail as a normal course of action? So we went back 10 years. to look at 2,800 different interviews of data across a 10-year span.
And I'm sorry to interrupt. That's such a fantastic number because people don't realize the amount of energy and effort that goes into recruiting for a C-level executive. I just want to build up your answer.
It's absolutely, and the carnage of a failure is equally as painful. The magnitude of families that are destroyed and businesses that are destroyed and departments that are set back and objectives that were promising that are halted. It's an endless amount of carnage.
So I apologize to interrupt.
That's okay. No. So we said, we can do better. We absolutely can do better. So we went back and we not only isolated 2,800 interviews of data on an executive and their effectiveness, we also slow-motioned 100 executives in mid-ascent. We said, let's see if we can slow this down and watch them to see what are the landmines that get in their way, that trip them up. And sure enough, one of the biggest surprises was that it's a wonder they're all not failing. When you think about the executives, the landmines that are tripping them up, there are numerous things that organizations do that get in their way. So the first one, ascend, is just simply being put in a higher altitude. And what most executives are not prepared for it. When you go from a director to a vice president or whatever your organization calls the senior ranks, the altitude, we call it altitude sickness, just like when you climb a mountain and you get, thin air and you can't breathe, you're disoriented. Mm-hmm. Those executives are no different. Suddenly people are looking at them differently. Suddenly people are asking them different questions. Information they used to have access to is suddenly dried up. Things are really different and they're not prepared for that. When you adjust, part of that has to do with the dangers of how you arrived. So, for example, it is not uncommon in any kind of recruiting process for someone to say to an executive, oh my gosh, Charlie, you've turned 4 supply chains around before. Come turn ours around. Or, wow, you really have an impressive track record of building sales capability. We need that. Right. Or, my gosh, our brands are dying, but you look at the brands you've built. Come build our brands. Mm-hmm. The dangerous implied assumption in that is that there's some formula you have that you're simply meant to repeat. So instantly, as an executive, you're predisposed to reach back in your arsenal of experiences and take a recipe and slap it on the context that's in front of you as though it could work. And of course, it's a deadly failure. And almost
it's
all the time
it fails. Fascinating what you're saying, because as you were building up that answer, it almost sounded like, yeah. Like, what's wrong with that? And you're saying it's a deadly form of failure.
Think about it. Think about people you've watched in organizations who come in, gung-ho to make change, gung-ho with some, we call it the myth of the mandate, to make some improvement. If you don't read the context, if you don't understand what's happening in front of you, how could you possibly know if a solution you're going to offer is going to work? So, great example. One executive we studied, she was a renowned brand builder in consumer products brands, mostly cosmetics and that end of the spectrum, came into a consumer product brand that was a service. Completely different kinds of brands, completely different kinds of consumers, but she was a brand builder. And she looked at the organization and, of course, completely didn't see what she didn't know and tried to take her past successes of brands that were irrelevant and apply it to this organization. And, of course, it was a miserable failure. Mm. Well, what happens to that executive? They panic. So the more they panic, the harder they push their solution. And as they push harder, people back away.
Yeah.
We call this, their diagnosis becomes an indictment. So we've all heard it before. We walk in and the executive goes to their hiring manager and says, you didn't tell me it was this bad. And we've actually heard executives say things out loud like, how have you people stayed in business this long? Or how have you survived? And this suddenly, my shock becomes an indictment of the organization that's been there for a long time. Mm. And now, of course, they have no desire to try and support your agenda.
Right. Oh, no.
But it's so normal, Yitzhak.
Yeah.
It's so normal. So those are the kinds of...
So one is ascend, right. One is ascend.
And then the other is adjust to that thing. Once you land stick the landing, once you know you're going to stick, then there's assert. There's the issue of power. Suddenly you now have more influence, more authority, more resources to control, more decisions to affect than you ever had before. And many leaders struggle with that power to assert their will. We expected to find the abuses of power in the classic things we read about in the tabloids. Financial self-interest, immoral, unethical behaviors. And certainly we did find the abuse of power in self-interest, but that was not the predominance of a power abuse. The predominance of abuse of power was not the taking of it, it was the abandonment of it. it was the executives who could not tolerate and were too fearful of the power that came with their role, and so they didn't exert it at all. So they became paralyzed in decision-making. They became excessively accommodating to people to please them. They wanted to win people's favor by giving them what they wanted.
To the extent that it compromised their role as a C-level executive.
Severely attacked. Severely. Not only the role, but the results. So they couldn't assert their will. They couldn't assert power. But then those who are able to learn and gain muscle and gain traction then can affect. So now you have the chance to affect widespread change. You now can actually do what you were brought to do.
Now, just moving along, in San Francisco at a previous C-suite conference, I had the honor of attending your lecture. And you brilliantly discussed the issue of content versus context. I'm not even going to elaborate any further. You just take it away.
Yeah.
It was so eye-opening. Explain, please.
You know, about 15 years ago, we began to see an interesting trend in CEO tenure, and it dramatically went into a free fall. And CEO tenure was reducing below 5 years. Boards were becoming activist boards and acting on CEO poor performance and taking them out far sooner than most had ever seen. And in a spate of several years, we saw 18 or 19 public company major CEOs be taken out by their boards. And we thought this couldn't be coincidence. This can't be random that so much failure is happening. Why? So we studied the failures. We studied what was behind the appointment of a CEO, whether they came from within or whether they came from outside, and what was it that caused them to stumble so violently. The interesting thing was that in the majority of cases, the CEO is what we call a context leader. A context leader is someone who leads with vision, or leads by values, leads by relationship, leads by culture. A content leader leads by strategy, by direction, by organization, by process. One is not better than the other. If you think of it as a continuum, we ideally want leaders who are blends of content and context. But the truth is most leaders have a predisposition to one or the other. Mm. In the majority of failed cases, the context leader that was exiting was replaced by a COO or an incoming leader who was a content leader. And as that content leader stepped into the CEO role, suddenly had to create their own context, create values, create cohesion, create passion, rebuild a culture to adapt to a strategy, and they couldn't do it. And so the harder they had to grasp at the reins to try and get control of the organization, the more they suffocated it. And those leaders, you know, within 12 to 18 months as CEO, were taken out.
So I'm just going to divulge for a second. Are you in favor of some of the tools that are out there, either the Myers-Briggs or Colby or some of that other testing that might, I don't know, might reveal a certain tendency that a leader will have in a certain era, whether it's content or context?
You know, I think there are lots of great assessment tools out there that can provide great insights to leaders about their own behavior and how others experience that behavior. Certainly, I'd be more in favor of those who get data from around them, not just from them, that just more than self-reporting. But I think you can watch a leader's predispositions to one or the other by just simply watching how they make decisions, by watching how they lead, by watching where they spend their time.
Now, would you say that either content or context will determine if a CEO will be successful overall, or does it really depend on the position and on the past trends of that individual, the past characteristics?
It depends mostly on what the organization requires. So, for example, if you're in a highly disruptive industry where there's great change, great technological disruption, competitive forces, you better be a great context leader to great galvanizing of an enterprise. You presumably have people around you who know the content, who know the technology, the industry, the trends, what's disrupting them. If you're in an industry that's going to require, that's static, that's
okay,
at capacity, it's mature, it's
leading
a breakthrough.
Let's say the automotive
industry. Okay. There you better have content beyond the industry, because to see what's next, right, to see beyond the, you know, so we just heard Faith Popcorn talk about driverless cars. Well, right. Actually, there are car companies exploring that. Mercedes is one of them. But my guess is that it's not the traditional engineers that are doing it, right? You know, Google is testing their new driverless cars. Nobody can believe we're ever going to have driverless cars. Well, nobody can believe we're ever going to have cars either. 150 years ago. So the reality is that the person leading that effort better understand and have good predictive indices for where the industry is going. So, you know, whether you're a content or context leader, you know, play to your strengths, but make sure you surround yourself with leaders who complement what you bring.
Now, in your articles, in your book, you describe three times when a CEO may experience failure, and that's either early in their career, in the middle, or in the later part of the career. Is there a kind of a telltale sign that you would say causes failures in each of these stages of their career?
Yeah, sure. So new CEOs can be impulsive. They come in, they've got the mandate of a board, they want to prove themselves, they want to make change quickly, they want to establish their authority and differentiate from whoever preceded them. And so sometimes they make wickedly impulsive decisions. Or they get paralyzed. They go native. They can become part of the landscape to the severe degree that they actually can't see the need for change. So that's often early career CEO failure. Okay. But let's imagine a CEO can get past that, get some momentum behind some agenda, get some strategy that's changing, and begin to renew the organization from wherever they inherited it. Sometimes in the tenure of a CEO, midway through there'll be a crisis. Some unforeseen trend in the marketplace, some national catastrophe or disaster, mm-hmm. something that actually puts the business into a hairpin turn.
Yeah, I mean, we'll take CEOs of airlines during 9/11, after 9/11.
No, there was no playbook for that, right? So those leaders that don't have the agility, don't have the perseverance, don't have the tenacity to be able to dig deep and say, okay, we've been dealt a new hand here. We need to recover. We need to rebound. We need to reconfigure and adjust. They paralyze. They freeze up in the face of public scrutiny, in the face of angry employees, in the face of fearful marketplace or consumers. Mm-hmm. They don't know what to do, and so they can't go on.
Wow. Now, you talk about something called fundamental character failure that affects sometimes CEOs or C-level executives. What does that mean?
Well, it's actually one of the reasons for late career CEO failure. A lot of times, CEOs get very comfortable. And so you see the trappings of power become too much for them. And there's this sense of imperviousness that overcomes them. They can't. They think they're impenetrable to consequence. They think they can't get caught. And you think in the face of the presence of all kinds of social media and security cameras, nobody would ever conclude they can't get caught. You should just assume that everything you're doing is on the front page of the Wall Street Journal. Just assume that. But so the trappings of their influence, their wealth, their power become too much for them, and they make really poor choices.
Wow. We're speaking with Ron Carucci, world-renowned leadership consultant and best-selling author, right here on Mind Your Business, 77 WABC in the New York, New Jersey metro area, and around the world at WABCBizRadio.com. We're going to take a short commercial break. Stay tuned.
Did you know that dissatisfied employees cost American businesses over $300 billion each year? Now there's a solution. TeamAhead.co. Team Ahead is a complete solution to help companies of all sizes build a positive corporate culture. Team Ahead helps today's thought leaders make their vision a legacy. Team Ahead's comprehensive approach helps you communicate your vision and engage your employees through many channels, including print, digital, sweepstakes, video, events, social media, and a custom website. Call 800-890-1807, extension 3505 to find out how Team Ahead can transform your business's corporate culture, leading to greater productivity and revenue. Call toll-free 800-890-1807, extension 3505, or visit teamahead.co. Team Ahead will enhance your workplace productivity, boost morale, and successfully communicate your vision. Don't let your company's strongest asset be its biggest liability. Call toll-free 800-890-1807, extension 3505, or visit teamahead.co to fuel your winning workplace today.
Best Payroll delivers the affordable payroll solutions you need so that you could focus on your business. Today's payroll laws are complicated and constantly changing. Why should you have to worry about keeping yourself up to date with these details when you can rely on Best Payroll's fully bonded tax service to take care of it for you? Best Payroll has been managing the payroll needs of small to mid-sized companies across the country since 1989. Their experienced and dedicated professionals are committed to providing you with cost-effective payroll management solutions. Why spend your time, money, and effort handling your business's payroll when you could rely on Best Payroll to get the job done right at a price you can't beat? To learn more what Best Payroll can do for your company, dial 347-729-2355. That's 347-729-2355. Or visit bestpayroll.net. That's bestpayroll.net. Best Payroll, the experienced payroll professionals.
And we're back live from C-Suite Boston here in early spring, March. And I'm here with a very special guest, Ron Carucci, a leadership consultant, best-selling author, and actually his company, Navalent. Maybe you could just give us a little background about your company, what you do.
Sure. We're 11 years old. We're a boutique management consulting firm that specializes in helping executives execute strategy, build organizations, and strengthen their leadership capability.
Now, I again, you could feel free to take a pass on this question. Perhaps you could list some of the three most famous clients or three clients that just amazed you. Are you allowed to do that on the air?
Sure. I can give them a prop.
A teaser.
Some of them, okay. Some of them, their stories are in the book.
Okay.
One was a small family-owned business in Los Angeles, but an amazing leader. His name is Tom Stilwell, and he inherited the business from his father with his brothers.
Okay.
And when we got there, there was some chaos, you know, like a small entrepreneurial company, but they had great visions to enter a marketplace that was quite audacious for them to enter. Taking over Hollywood by storm and working with the big producers and big studios there. And we spent about a year and a half with them, and what a remarkable change. And he's such an impressive leader. He's so passionate about his company and passionate about his people and an amazing young man.
Wow. Any other ones you care to share?
Sure. Dave West at the Hershey Company. He's also featured in our book. He a tremendous leader, especially you know after 11 years at the Hershey Company, taking that stock price from $40 to $82 a share. Brilliant man, smart guy, humble and caring, and you know always pushing for new ideas, pushing for the organization to behave well.
Wow.
Yeah.
Amazing stuff. Now, recently you published an article about the four traits of high-performing executives. Could you please share that for the audience?
So the findings from our research were, you know, for the 50% that are failing, what were the ones that were succeeding doing? And there were four consistent patterns. We did 99 different regression analyses to prove this partly because I didn't like the answer. I didn't want to have to say that all four of these were important. The truth was the exemplars in our study did all four well. And that's the price of entry to the C-suite. They are breadth. So these executives knew the entire organization. Even if they grew up in a discipline like marketing or sales or finance, when they got to the top, they could go from playing first chair to conductor. They understood how all the pieces fit together, and they could work the seams and make an integral whole out of the organization. They knew how their business made money. It's surprising to me, Itzhak, how many leaders, if you say to them, break apart your P&L, tell me how you make your money, tell me how you're differentiated from your competitors, tell me why people choose you over others. They can't answer the question. They give you counterfeit answers.
Wow.
These leaders knew the industry, they knew the trends, they knew what was disruptive, they knew what was coming, and they knew how their business made money. They were great decision makers. They knew how to assemble data, intuition, and others in the right combinations to build great choices as compared to those who either froze up or were too impulsive. And they had amazing relationships. They were beloved by their bosses, peers, and direct reports. Every company has that leader that everybody wants to work for, and these were them.
Wow. Is there a method or a test that could be done? I know we touched on this earlier, but now I'm going to ask it straight up. That could be done to determine if a potential candidate will succeed in that leadership position?
You know, I think there's, I mean, we have a bunch of assessment questions in our book for each of those four dimensions that help people identify and predict.
And again, the name of the book
is Rising to Power, The Journey of Exceptional Executives.
It's available on Amazon, Barnes & Noble. It's available at many of the airport, Hudson News retailers. It's available nationwide, worldwide. Yep. Okay, sorry.
So you can, you, you, the old cliche of past performance can be a good predictor of future performance is no different. So asking leaders how they've understood context, how they've spanned multiple boundaries of an organization, how they've established deep relationships, and how they've constructed decisions. Just having them tell you that those how they've done those things before or where they've struggled with those things can give you a good sense for how they're going to elevate. But most people think is that as people rise up in organizations, they get better. That somehow conferring on a higher level of a hierarchy confers upon them competence. What people don't realize is that it actually releases the pathologies. So if you're moody as a director, you're going to be a dark cloud as a vice president. If you're impulsive as a director, you're going to be a train wreck as a vice president. If you're a consensus builder as a director, you're going to be paralyzed as a vice president. People don't realize that as you get to the top, your innards become exposed. So whatever your predispositions are, they're only amplified at a higher role. I tell my clients all the time, leadership is the ability to disappoint people at a rate they can absorb. You have to be able to make hard calls.
Could you repeat that?
The ability to disappoint people at a rate they can absorb. And most leaders don't know they signed up for that. If you're going to be an executive, you're going to suffer. And nobody understands the pain that comes with being lonely at the top is a terrible cliche, but it's very true. The isolation, the pressure, the 24-hour scrutiny, the exposure, the vulnerability. These are very difficult jobs. We complain about the compensation by these men and women, especially when they're not proving to be competent, but the reality is they're extremely unforgiving.
I always felt that
jobs.
That was very unfair. When the press rips them apart, it's so meaning they don't rip apart a baseball player who's making $18, $20 million because they say, well, he has to prepare and he gets on the field and pressure. A CEO, my gosh, is he dealing with pressure? He's being compensated, not just for showing up 9 to 5. I mean, he's being
compensated 24/7.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Wow. Now, here's a loaded question that I'm sure you're asked, and we're speaking with Ron Carucci. I don't know if there's a better person to ask than yourself for this. When a company, a Fortune 500 company, is looking for a new CEO, a CMO, someone in that C-suite, should they begin by looking from within or from without?
Well, my hope is that they've long prepared inside. When you have to go outside in the C-suite, you're inserting all kinds of risk. Those are very dangerous, fraught searches. And so if a company at that level of the organization has not prepared somebody, a successor, for many years, they failed. And frankly, boards should be holding them accountable. Some of our clients have been boards, public company boards, who have called us in to help prepare succession processes for top jobs. Because you cannot assimilate to the top of an organization from outside without tremendous difficulty and risk. And so if organizations don't have robust processes, and I don't mean let's write down a slate of candidates and put the same five names in all 20 spots, right? We've seen that movie. But I mean truly preparing leaders from, you know, 5-7 years earlier for pathways toward bigger jobs inside. So they're learning their job, they're learning the rest of the organization, and they're learning your organization. So that when you get to the top, you have a much higher degree of success when you transition somebody who's been prepared for years to take on a bigger job.
I remember years ago reading a book, I really like his stuff, John Maxwell, about, I think it was the 17 irrefutable laws.
21 irrefutable laws.
The 21 irrefutable laws. And there he talks about, I don't remember I think Coca-Cola was one of them, maybe GE, but of course those come to mind as ones that have such an incredible leadership building culture in place that like anything could happen to the top, I mean, God forbid, but you know, tomorrow someone will be ready to step into anyone's shoes, kind of, you know, in order to go further. Another question about scaling from within: have you seen a person be successful almost as a sole proprietor or as an entrepreneur, but then really scaling? Have you seen that? Or is that rare?
Here's what makes it hard. Most founding entrepreneurs, whether it's a product or a service or technology, it's their baby. It's they're in love with it. They love their idea. And the minute it begins to show wild levels of success, ironically, their identity becomes very linked to it. And so the idea of scaling means letting go. It means putting it into the hands of others. It means you stepping back and building an organization around that asset so that it can have a life beyond you. And many entrepreneurs struggle to do that.
Wow. So because in your book, Rising to Power, you talk about one of the hardest parts is transitioning into a leadership role is really from distancing yourself from these little, you know, detailed day-to-day stuff that you are into looking at the whole vision. I mean, that's what a CEO has to do, kind of, you know, from the control tower viewpoint. But you say it's hard for someone to do that, but it's possible?
It's very possible for entrepreneurs to learn, as long as they understand that think about a baby in the womb might go through mitosis. We call it organizational mitosis. You're dividing. You're constantly growing and changing, and you have to keep, and most, we walk into mid-cap companies, we often find $20, $30, $40 million companies trapped in the bodies of $2 million companies. Because they never scaled, they never matured. They just got the call from Costco, and they put up a new line, or they got the call from a bunch of
Walmart, new orders, whatever.
And now they're just having to produce stuff. And we'll ask, okay, what happens when they stop calling? What have you got? Right? Leaders have to be able to go at whatever stage of maturity their business is at, from working in the organization to working on the organization, and understand that their job is an architect now. It's no longer to be the chief scientist of a chief entrepreneur, right, of a chief salesperson. They have to go to be from being first chair to conductor.
How does a leader navigate conflict?
Most of them poorly. One of two things happens. You either see the leader who is conflict averse. They don't like to assert their will. They don't want to upset people. They certainly don't want to, in front of people, have dissent. Or they're bullies. They live to not belittle people, or they have to have their way. They always have to be right. And any open sense of dissent is actually seen as disloyalty. Both those extremes are obviously unhealthy. Right. Leaders who can, and actually women do this much better than men, leaders who can actually embrace that conflict is the raw material of innovation. If you have no conflict, somebody's not necessary. And so dissent is the best precursor for breakthrough. But you have to tolerate it, and you have to not personalize it, and you have to, you should invite dueling fact bases to the table. You know, what should we do with this decision? What does the data say? Well, the finance person has one interpretation of the data, the marketing person has another. Okay, let's duke it out. Let's let the...
Right, in a healthy way, obviously in a comfortable environment.
Absolutely.
But everyone, you know, speak up and, you know, let's talk it out.
Yep, absolutely. And let's enjoy it, and then we'll make a decision, let's link arms and execute it. And not everybody has to always have their way.
In your book, you talk about when you become a CEO, there is no small talk. How should a leader communicate?
My gosh, I can't tell you how many executives lament to me when they get to higher jobs or CEO spots. Mm-hmm. Everybody's saying Ron said. I never said that. Everybody's quoting me as if I said these things. What most executives have to accept is that you now walk around as if you have a bullhorn strapped to your mouth 24/7. Everything you say is amplified. Everything you do is on the Jumbotron. So in the elevator, people are watching. They attach meaning to everything. Did his eyebrow go up? What kind of mood is he in? Is he walking fast? And they want to decode you. And so when you ask people questions, when you give a point of view, when you express yourself, when you ask questions, recognize that the opportunity for misinterpretation, the opportunity for overinterpretation is huge. And you have to be very thoughtful. And not that you should be paranoid about people misinterpreting everything you might say, but be mindful that because of your role, everything is amplified, and it might go somewhere you didn't intend.
Wow. We're speaking with Ron Carucci right here on 77 WABC. We're going to take a short commercial break. Stay tuned.
Author, radio host, and president of Bottom Line Marketing Group, Yitzhak Saflis, has written the essential book for the success-driven, fast-paced professional. So, What's the Bottom Line? Is a must-read for marketing your business and building your personal brand. Former U.S. Congressman and media executive Bob Turner describes So, What's the Bottom Line? As a compass to guide the experienced executive or marketing novice through any step in planning or organizing a selling strategy. So, What's the Bottom Line? Is available now on Amazon, Barnes & Noble, and bookstores nationwide. Get your copy today.
Did you know that dissatisfied employees cost American businesses over $300 billion each year? Now there's a solution. TeamAhead.co. TeamAhead is a complete solution to help companies of all sizes build a positive corporate culture. TeamAhead helps today's thought leaders make their vision a legacy. TeamAhead's comprehensive approach helps you communicate your vision and engage your employees through many channels, including print, digital, sweepstakes, video, events, social media, and a custom website. Call 800-890-1807, extension 3505 to find out how Team Ahead can transform your business's corporate culture, leading to greater productivity and revenue. Call toll-free 800-890-1807, extension 3505, or visit teamahead.co. Team Ahead will enhance your workplace productivity, boost morale, and successfully communicate your vision. Don't let your company's strongest asset be its biggest liability. Call toll-free 800-890-1807, extension 3505, or visit teamahead.co to fuel your winning workplace today.
And we're back. Mind Your Business with Yisroch Saflis right here on 77 WABC in the New Jersey metro area and around the world at WABCBizRadio.com. There you go. WABCBizRadio.com. And in case you missed any of the previous podcasts, they're all available by going to WABCBizRadio.com. They're all up there. In fact, you could watch the one. They're actually, many of them have become highlight videos. In fact, this particular episode with Ron Carucci is also going to be a highlight video that will go up that you could watch. But let's say the show that we recently had with Ron Carr, a sales expert. That was an incredible show, and the video is also up. What about the one we had with Jeffrey Heise? Julia Waller, unique ability coach and specialist. We talked to her about unique ability, understanding yourself, and like this you'll be able to leverage your talents to the max. What about the interview we have with Linda Kaplan Thaler, former chairman of Publicis, and actually an inductee into the Advertising Hall of Fame. What about the one with Dan Sullivan, president and founder of Strategic Coach? That was also an incredible one to understand how to protect your time properly. Well, tonight we are here live from, actually this is a pre-recorded show, live from Boston. We were at the C-Suite Conference, a really incredible event, and here I had a chance to catch up with Ron Carucci. Ron Carucci is a world-renowned leadership consultant and best-selling author. His most recent book, he's written 8 books. His most recent one, Rising to Power, The Journey of Exceptional Executives, is actually a number one bestseller. Ron, let's talk a little bit about corporate culture at the conference. Me and Pesach Trapper from my team, we rolled out our new product called Team Ahead, which has to do with building corporate culture. We have a client, L&R Distributors. They have 1,100 employees nationwide, and they rolled out a great concept about building corporate culture. But we were involved in the community. Our firm does bottom line marketing. We do all types of the execution phase of any marketing campaign. That's the nuts and bolts of it. Talk about building corporate culture. How important is it for a leader to communicate his vision, his or her vision, from the top down to every last person on the bus?
Well, I think most leaders who are not in a coma have some sense that culture is a critical part of their organization, especially at the top of the house, because it's the one lever they pull hardest at to change and it's the most elusive. The problem with people who do corporate culture work, and I love what you guys do, is that you embed it. It's not just a campaign. No. Most really bad corporate culture work is sloganeering. We'll put values on the wall. We'll put them on the mugs. We'll put them on screensavers.
Great point.
Integrity,
kind of
teamwork.
Kind of one-time thing. Just boom, and yay, right. It's all solved.
And we all know what they are. They're integrity, teamwork, diversity.
Right. Yay.
Respect. Right, we know the 20 top ones. Somebody went on Google and Google values, and we took the most common ones and we put them on. And the truth is, those always fail, and they're insulting. Employees are insulted, especially when leaders use culture to correct. Right, so we had one organization we worked with for many years where the CEO, the culture struggled in many ways, and suddenly he rolled out a whole brand new values program that mysteriously all were values meant to correct the behavior of the culture he couldn't change. Well, when people look at the culture, the whatever the codification of it is, and they cannot see themselves in the story, or worse, they see that it's a weapon used against them to fix them, guess what? They're not going to play. So a culture should be designed and named around what the strategy requires. So if you're going to value speed or customer service or execution or respect or whatever language, and now the latest trend is to get really kitschy and fun with the words, it still needs to be a reflection of what you're trying to accomplish in the marketplace. Then it needs to be embedded. You have to look at compensation processes. How often do we say we want teamwork and then our entire compensation structure rewards individual behavior? We want everybody engaged and our governance processes have all the decision making at the top. So you have to align the entire system of the organization to deliver and encourage and promote the behaviors you say you want in your culture, and it should discourage behaving in ways that contradict it. Most people don't do that work. They put the campaign on the wall, everybody gets the screensaver, the mug, and the mouse pad, and that's it.
Right. It's not sustained. Right. No, our campaign we're doing with them is a 12-month campaign, and hopefully renewed after that, but that's that phase. Thank you. In your book, you discuss how to size up talent and build your team. Please explain.
So many executives, when they arrive into whatever big role they've come into from wherever they've come, they inherit a team. They don't get to start from scratch.
Right.
So not every executive should take a team intact and is likely to be able to succeed working with all of them. And so whatever their particular agenda has to be or whatever they've got to get done in their tenure in the role, they've got to look and, critically at, do I have the right team for that?
Wow.
Many leaders, unfortunately, wholesale, impulsively change out a team too quickly. Many of them stick with a team too long. And then eventually they too go native. And so it becomes too difficult to remove one of them. Executives, in the painful world of cost cutting, they'll do a reduction in force of 20,000 employees, no problem. But ask them to fire someone on their team, you'd ask, it's like removing a kidney with no anesthesia. It's too painful for them.
Oof.
If it's somebody they appointed, they can't even see the blind spots. They cannot fire somebody they hired. So you've got to have a critical eye at your team. You've got to know you've got the people around you who can accomplish what you've set out to accomplish so that you're not carrying dead weight or carrying people who are contradicting what you're trying to get done.
Wow. And it's, I mean, you said it like it is. You know, if there's a member on the bus that just doesn't belong there, got it, as painful as it is, you got to deal with it.
Well, everybody knows it. And so what most executives fail to realize, Yitzhak, is, what message are you sending to the entire organization by letting them stay?
Great point. Great point. I mean, everyone knows it. Everyone knows this person, you're just holding on and...
Or they play golf with you, or they're dating your daughter, you know, whatever. But the reality is, if they're undermining the entire organization's ability to succeed and you're keeping them there, you're just condoning...
Wow. Wow.
...mediocrity.
Wow.
And so everybody else who's contributing and giving has to ask themselves privately or publicly, why should I care?
Yeah. Now, we talked before about building corporate culture, but any other tips from your lifetime of experience on engaging employees?
Gosh, what a horrible report card we've all been delivered in that 70% number we've all heard, right? It's an indictment of leadership today that we're checked out. I did a piece on LinkedIn called An Open Letter to the 70%ers. And rather than talking about them, I wanted to talk to them. And I think you got to understand that, you know, it's one thing to be the painful part about great talent quitting and leaving is one thing, but when your talent has quit and stayed, it's another. Mm. And you have to be deeply disturbed by the fact that you've got 40 to 70% of your workforce sitting at desks not contributing in ways they want to. I think people come to work wanting to contribute. So my next HBR piece actually talks about this. How do big companies reinvent themselves and stay relevant again? Because those are the... What used to be the pinnacle of careers, when you and I were growing up, everybody wanted to work for IBM or GE.
Right, sure.
Big companies now are the employer of last resort. People would rather not work. When you think about 70% of the workforce checked out and 44% of the workforce being freelancers, it's either leaving or quitting and staying. So if big companies want to be able to attract talent, they've got to design creative jobs. Right now the jobs are boring. They're not creating jobs that people can contribute their talents in. They've got to stop faking having multiple directions. You've got to unify people around something that they care about. We've got to stop deceit. Nobody, 85% of most people in the workforce expect their boss to lie to them.
That's
so crazy. If I don't trust the integrity of the organization I'm in, if I don't expect to be told the truth, if I expect to be screwed, I'm going to leave half myself home.
Yeah, and time and time again, and every report has come out that trust probably ranks up as either the top or certainly in the top three items that someone wants to deal with, whether it's a client-vendor relationship, whether it's an employee-boss, whatever it is, yep. Trust ranks up there. Marriage, trust is right up there. And when 85% feel that they're not being told the truth, yep. Oh, wow.
So imagine, as simple as they sound, if big companies started telling the truth, making jobs really work for what they need to be done. I mean, how many young professionals will lament, I'm underemployed. I'm not using the degree I was trained to use. Create great jobs that are exciting. And move in one direction. Stop splintering. If they just did those three things, imagine what big companies could be again.
Interesting question. And we know how important it is to reward employees, reward talent. Would you say that a fulfilling job is perhaps even more important to a great employee, to retaining a great employee than the compensation package?
Oh my gosh,
it's a loaded question. I'm sorry.
How many years have we seen the Harvard study that money is rarely the top motivator? I think it's in the last 20 years of what people most want at work. Challenging, engaging workers at the top. Compensation is number five, somewhere between 5 and 7. It's never at the top. People will quit jobs and take less money for jobs that are more rewarding and fulfilling.
I read in one of your works, a quote, when you see promising talent, move it around. Is it necessary to expose team members to broader parts of an organization?
Absolutely. If you want great executive talent leader, great general management capability, you've got to get people out of the silos, out of the disciplines. Sure, they may always be brilliant marketers or brilliant financiers or brilliant innovators, but you want to make a great finance person, put them in the supply chain. You want to create a brilliant marketer, put them in the sales force. You want to create a great salesperson, make them work in the supply chain. Because those are the interdependent parts of a organization that have to produce the results in the marketplace. If you don't understand how those pieces fit together, you'll play just to the one strength you know. So if you've got great talent, broaden it. That's the best thing you can. Obviously, deepen it in some areas so that everybody has a homeroom. But broaden that talent and expose it to other work experiences so that as they rise up, they're going to be great executives.
Now, here's an interesting question. Do you find that there's any benefit that a leader or a CEO actually not just went through the system but experienced the actual role of the team? I'll give an example. Let's say the CEO of Delta. Is there an advantage of if the CEO was actually a pilot, or if the CEO of UPS was actually a driver who delivered boxes for UPS? Is there an advantage?
It's a blessing and a curse, right? So you have lots of folks, people at Chick-fil-A as a great example, all grew up through the stores. You have plenty of examples of executives who came up through the ranks of the company. The upside to that is the credibility they have, right? They know the business. They know the people. They have amazing stories.
They lived it. They breathed it.
And so people have tremendous loyalty to that leader. The downside is their perspective is short-lived. So their ability to see opportunities for change will be much narrowed because they came from inside. So their ability to see the organization as an outsider is impaired. And executives have to be able to see what's broken, to see what needs to be changed, not just incrementally for improvements, but in every industry there's disruption. In every industry there are discontinuities that are coming. And pure insiders that come up, it's rare that you have a purely grown-up insider that can actually see around the corner that way. So it's a blessing and a curse.
Now, we talked before about some of the people you run into, but I'm going to approach the question from a different way. Would you be able to name some top CEOs that you've done business with and some of the key lessons that you were impressed by from them?
Well, let me go back to the two I mentioned before. So in Tom's case, you can't underestimate the price of caring. He and his brothers owned that company. I've heard dozens of leaders say to their people, act like you own it. But you wind up having to say that because people are behaving as if they don't care, right? This is a family-owned business. And the 300 or 400 employees in that company, they owned it. They were impassioned by the services they provided to their clients. And it was such an inspiring thing to watch. And so they had to go through amazingly disruptive change to reinvent that company, to build it to the beautiful thing it is now, and they just won several Clio awards. So that was a whole new space for them to go play in. I think from Dave, you know, the thing that I loved watching him was the credibility you get as a leader when you're humble and honest, when you're accessible to others. You know, there's a cost to pay for that kind of vulnerability, but he was really accessible to people. Didn't have to be the smartest kid in the class, but he was. And he cared about his people. He was a very down-to-earth, accessible leader, and so people trusted him.
Here's another question. I mean, we all experience failures at some point in our lives, our careers. Any advice for how someone could pick themselves up after a bad fall, especially for, obviously, C-level?
My mentor, she's been a mentor for 25 years. She and I taught at Fordham together. She taught me early on in my career, there's nothing irrevocable except death. And, you know, I mean, we've heard all the cliches, if you're not failing, you're not growing. If you're not failing, you're not trying anything. Sure, failure is inevitable. It still sucks. So, you know, the level of resilience you're not going to build resilience until you fail. You know, you wouldn't call it perseverance if you weren't thinking of quitting. Right. And so part of life is just learning to skin your knees well. And when you do, first and foremost, will you be kind to yourself? And will you be kind to others in that failure? Will you be humble and learn? Will you not be full of self-contempt? Will you not be full of hubris and dismiss it? You know, who will you be in that failure? And who do you want to become as a result of that failure? Those are the hard questions. And if you can answer those early, failure won't be such a detriment to you.
As we approach the close, can we ask you on the air if you're up to any new titles, working on any new books?
So not any new books now, no, but okay. This piece for HBR on organization. So we, in all the research we used for Rise into Power, we only used actually half of it for that book. Most of it was on the individual leaders. We have a whole other pile of information we've yet to analyze on organizations. So it breaks my heart to see large companies declining. You know, stodgy, once beautiful brands be the places nobody ever wants to go work. Well, we're never not going to have big companies. Right. You know, and I mean by big, let's just say 500 million and above.
Right.
But if we don't learn how to be big companies differently than we know how to do it today, no, you can't have 80% of the workforce be freelancers.
Yeah,
but I mean, we have to have so we have to fix it, but we should fix it before it becomes a disaster.
Ron, I can't thank you enough for joining me here on Mind Your Business. As we approach the close, any final thoughts for the audience?
Yitzhak, thanks so much for having me. It's been a real pleasure. I hope your listeners enjoy and are provoked by some of the insights. You know, the thing I would tell any leader in an organization,
aspiring leader or aspiring entrepreneur,
right, is, and they probably heard it a million times, but you don't take it to heart, love what you do. And love the people you do it with.
Passion.
Yeah.
Passion. Special thank you to Ron Carucci, world-renowned leadership consultant, best-selling author. How could they get in touch with your company?
You can find us at www.navalent.com or info@navalent.com.
Amazing. And the author of Executive Power, available Amazon, Barnes & Noble, Hudson News, go to your local bookstore. You could pick it up. Special thank you to Ron Carucci for joining me here. We're recording live from C-Suite Boston, one of the great events run by Jeffrey Hazlett and his team, Tom White, Carl Post. Special thank you to Ron Carucci for joining me here tonight.
Yitzhak, thanks so much for having me.
And that was a great interview that we just had with Ron Carucci. I mean, the listeners of Mind Your Business realize that we spend quite some time, Pesach Trapper, special thank you to him, and other members on the team at Bottom Line Marketing Group, spend an enormous amount of time seeking out high-level guests that can impart so much knowledge and information. And this interview, in case you missed it, it will be available in a day or two on the iTunes store. The easiest way to access it is by going to wabcbizradio.com, wabcbizradio.com. And in fact, a lot of times people ask me during the week, they're like, okay, how can I find out who your upcoming guest will be? Well, it's very simple. We always tweet it out. We send it through our social media channels. So on Facebook, there's actually a special page, the Mind Your Business page. It's up on Facebook or on Twitter. If you're a Twitter person, my handle is Y Saftless, Y Saftless, S-A-F-T-L-A-S. and we let the world know. We also let the world know through LinkedIn. Yitzchak Saftlas, YitzchokSaftlas, and the information there is posted about our upcoming guests, and that's how you would have found out about Ron. But again, if you happen to unfortunately miss the previous 52-53 minutes of this evening, you can access it by going to WABC Biz Radio in a couple of days, and you can access the entire interview. Well, as we approach the close, a special thank you again to Pesach Trapper. A special thank you to Jeffrey Hazlett and Carl Post and Tom White, the leaders at the C-Suite Network, for inviting us to the C-Suite Conference. We came to you live from Boston. Special thank you to Srili Saftlas, who orchestrated all the technical arrangements necessary to bring this radio show, you know, live from Boston and to come over the airways at 77 WABC, and of course the great team at 77 WABC. Stay tuned next for John Batchelor. He's up right after the network break at the top of the hour. And tune in again next Sunday evening at 11 p.m. for another great edition of Mind Your Business right here on 77 WABC.
77 WABC Radio presents Mind Your Business, hosted by founder and president of Bottom Line Marketing Group, Yitzhak Saflis. Mind Your Business focuses on business and marketing strategies for success. Tune in every Sunday night from 11 until 12 for this intriguing weekly radio show that's chock full of business insights and marketing strategies that will help you get ahead of the game. Host Yitzhak Saflis has been producing pioneering and creative marketing work for over two decades. He leads a team of marketing experts who help their clients build their brands and grow their businesses. Now, he and his guests offer their business and marketing expertise to you every Sunday night from 11 until midnight on Mind Your Business.
This podcast is a part of the C-Suite Radio Network. For more top business podcasts, visit c-suiteradio.com.